thought the aspect of the aspect of restoration for the one who causes the injury has a lot to do with realizing what's really important and kind of reorienting themselves to not what I think is important, but what's important for us and the connection between two people. I also thought about number four, the injuring partners now take ownership of how they inflicted this injury on their other and express regret and remorse. At first, I was thrown back, you know, saying, oh, I have to express regret and remorse. Like, I have to conjure that up somewhere. But then I thought more about the idea of how the injury being more about the pain and the, what was it said? The anger, the hurt and the anger being legitimate in the person who was injured. I felt like it, I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to say, but I thought they have to be, you have to see the pain and the hurt as legitimate in order to actually get to that stuff.
Exactly. And not only understand it,
yeah,
taking the word see, you need to see it, but not just in the sense of understanding. Also, she says that express clearly.
But it's about seeing what's really important. Right. Because no matter whether you're right or wrong in your argument, what's really important is the fact that you hurt the other person.
Right.
And that, you know, even if they shouldn't be hurt, they're still hurt because of some circumstance or history or something about their family system or something like that. It's legitimate. And so just the fact that they're hurt means it needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah. So that's really well said.
One of my daughters, I've learned much about this from, I had a daughter who also said, why are you so defensive? I have a lot of defense of you. You said something, mm-hmm, and I'm telling you the circumstances, but that was really good to hear. But first of all, it's just, I am really sorry that hurt you. And it's, I am so sorry that hurt you. And then later on, she told me, a friend of hers taught her this. Tell me more about that. What was that like? Let me enter, because I don't understand. Because it's all rational to me, and it's all explainable. So how did that hurt you? Tell me more about that. Is there anything? I mean, really dig. And boy, that just opens up the whole thing. Safe spot, safe spot. I want to make that right.
There's also somebody behind me that wants to speak.
You're so perceptive.
I have an observation and then I have a question. But my observation would be, I remember early in a relationship having a semblance of this. And finding, you know, afterwards that it was like one, you know, big, I don't know, orchestra or whatever, but there was reprisals later. Like, it wasn't just one and done. If the injury's big, sometimes you kind of need to go through it again. And one thing that we talked about was just being the importance of being really vulnerable, especially if you're the injuring party, to just go, be able to go back to it, right? Because sometimes you might want to open up and say, I understand how you feel. Okay, now it's past. Like, don't bring it up again.
Right.
And kind of this conversation, you know, we need to be prepared when that hurt comes back up to just bring it up again and say, this is coming back. And again, here, again, I'm sorry, I forgive you again, like, over and over. And the thing that I found really amazing is, like, when you kind of get past the defensiveness, because I'm, again, an explainer and a defender normally, and you get past the defensiveness and you're just like, I'm just open, it almost is kind of freeing for the injured person to go back. It's not a painful thing. It's like, yes, please, let me tell you again that it's past, you have to be on it. So that's something I wanted to share. My question was, I don't remember the definition of the capital never again. So is that a good or a bad thing? Like, never again, does that mean you're saying this
it's
will never happen again?
It's not a good thing. What she means is not a good thing. It's the vow to not be hurt. I'm not gonna let him
hurt
me.
So it's not the injured person saying,
me.
I'll never do that again. It's, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It must be like getting a little bit late on Saturday. Just, I'm not remembering something from 45 seconds ago. It's the short-term memory, you know, in terms of effectiveness, gets shorter and shorter. I can do the long-term stuff, like, you know. Yeah.
No, that's all right. And just in the other half here, what she was referring to before, just making sure that was clear, is that we find if the hurt's big enough, sometimes it can be small, but it's not. We don't live in this skin-cut world where you deal with it, you forgive, and you move on. Mm-hmm. Because we all still have memories and stuff, attachments and things, and that comes back up, or if you're brought back up by something that was intended. And so we said very, very, very early on, because you kind of came to a really, really big time when you need to be full ability, full request of forgiveness, full acceptance, all that kind of stuff. But this is going to come back up again, because this has been part of my life. So this is going to keep coming back up, because I'm going to keep remembering this, and it does come back up, and you go to you again and say,
I don't know how you guys managed to do that, particularly early, but it's really amazing. You have no way of knowing, you don't have the data, but it's, most of us don't. We don't turn those hard moments into such an advantageous moment, such a learning moment. But you reminded me of what I was thinking about. It's the idea of that, yeah, it can't be the one and done, or often cannot be the one and done, you know, okay. And going on with that, that actually sets people up, like the rational ones, for failure pretty quickly, because we will forget. And, you know, that's a problem. So one of the experts that I admire the most, who writing, working on infidelity, made this statement that the person who, you know, was not the offender, who was betrayed, needs a year of mourning. And he went on to explain that as, he or she gets a whole year to ask whatever they want to ask that they're not going to know initially. And I think that's because grieving, especially big things, takes a long time. Well, a year might not be long enough, but he was wise enough to know there has to come a place where you say, okay, we together, you know, agree, you know, we've given it enough time, we're going to move on now. Kind of close that issue. But example, with my father dying when I was five, five-year-olds don't really, you know, not agree. Can't really process that, can't do anything with that. So when I was 26 and my wife's mother died, I went into this huge tailspin, which at the time was sort of, I sort of had a presence of mind enough to kind of wonder, is this really about my dad? Why it was also about Dorothy. And I thought, well, I'll know, because my dad died on February 10th. My birthday, February 17th. And I would sort of see the 10th coming. And then on the 10th, I really didn't think about it very much. Usually around the 12th, 13th, you know, somewhere in there, starting to approach my birthday, I kind of go, oh, I've really been depressed lately. Of course, I always get depressed around this time of year, and I did, you know, just every year that I recognize. So, but after Dorothy died and went through all of that, I kind of thought, well, if I'm really grieving Dad now, maybe I won't go through that depression and celebrate that anniversary. And I did the next year. She died in September. The next, you know, 5, 6, 7 months later, and really haven't since then. My life more than that. But I wasn't done. That was sort of the initiating of the grieving process. And then gradually over time, there'd be another aspect of the loss. One that stands up in my mind was when my oldest daughter was 15, so like 19 years ago. my oldest brother wrote a letter saying, this summer at such and such a time would have been our parents' 50th wedding anniversary. We ought to do something to mark it. And we did. But I'm reading that letter. My daughter's on the floor doing some homework. I look up from that letter, look at her, and things start running through my mind that were losses, the things I don't know in terms of, because Dad is gone. Always has been practical for me. I don't know what he would have been like as a grandparent. He does. Our kids are amazing, and he doesn't know my kids. I don't get the joy of seeing my father know my kids. I just kind of go through that list. That was just something else to bring. At that point, there'd been enough of the process. It didn't take very long. It wasn't any tailspin. It was really that evening. There'd been one before that where I went through a pretty long list that it took some time of the things that I missed or the things that my dad missed because he was dead. And there were things like, and things that I did alone. So, you know, at the top of my list, one of the first ones came was like that first home run I hit literally when I was 12. And no one was there. I can remember going home telling my brothers, yeah, they cared, but then it's my brothers. I was sort of like, oh, that's cool. You know, I'm with business. I was like, and I'm actually approaching tears at this moment because I'm kind of getting close to that. But that was a huge loss for me. That, I don't know, I was 30 or 40 something years old before I ever started even recognizing. Okay. But back to the principle of, in these situations, there's a loss involved, and there are aspects. It's like the facets of a diamond to the loss. So we can have that great conversation, but there's a lot of wisdom in knowing this is going to come back, and it could come back up in other ways. We need to leave the door open to have some good connection around those other ways as well. So you guys intuitively know how to do that. Cool. Give lessons on that. That's what
I really learned it from
him. Yeah, you learn it together. That's the cool part. Other thoughts or questions?
I think that, you know, that it's interesting to talk about it this way in terms of more debt. But life in a relationship doesn't work that way. It's clean to talk about it in terms of a offender and somebody that's injured. But you know, the reality is that every event that you walk into, there's two sides to it. And there's the cycle that you were talking about. And I was just thinking about the year. You know, you think about it almost, this is gross to talk about it this way, but you talk about it in terms of like a tally sheet. Like, oh, here's a big offense, you know, and so we're going to get through this. But then while you're sort of, while somebody's dealing with a big offense, they're heaping potential, you know, injury into that situation from the other side, you know, and it's this interesting sort of, there's all of these moving parts that are, you know, sort of operating on that, and it's interesting to sort of talk about it this way in terms of each event or each communication, each attachment, each connection, you know, has got this baggage behind it, you know, or around it or in it. And from the standpoint of injury, you know, somebody recognizes, yeah, hey, I did that. But the fact that somebody is taking as long to process that forgiveness as they are, frankly, is a point of injury for the person that did the injury.
Yes, it is.
You know,
and yes, that is my ringtone. I should have shut the ring off. Sorry.
But you know, it's complicated. It's hairy. It's messy. You know, and I keep coming back to, you know, so these are good tools. You know, recognize that you have these things that you bring to bear on an issue, or argument, discussion, a point of connection that we keep talking about. But ultimately, it comes down to a place where you're going to decide to love that person across from you in that moment. Realize that that's my place. And recognize that there's growth that can take place here, and there's a greater intimacy that can develop out of this and attempt to go down the road rather than the road. person is setting out basically to hurt me. They don't care,
right.
And they don't love me. But, you know, I mean, it's so easy to believe that, especially for somebody that's constantly hurting, one way or the other, you know, that's constantly at odds with, you know, what you feel like you need. And, you know, constantly is, maybe it's not as constant as others, but I guess what I'm saying is, I'm interested, I look at these things, I'm like, wow, these are some new tools, this is an interesting process, you know, but it's so complicated. You know, emotionally, it's complicated, because every day, there's a different interaction that brings, you know, that has emotion around it, and how does that play on what you're trying to deal with from the day before, you know, or from the week before, or from a lifetime.
See, you?
Yeah.
So you brought me to I need to say one thing. And it is, in a sense, an effort to simplify. And all of a sudden I think, oh, I might have started sort of making it up on the spot. The last half of this top three list, it's actually, I separated things into triplets and doublets, if that's a word. But it was really all kind of one thing. What does this look like? Life? Find your own heart. Start speaking more to your heart. Start looking for your spouse's quiet parts. Grow curiosity. Ask questions. Ask more questions. Sit together your togetherness. Find comfort in each other. Pursue this accessibility, responsiveness, engagement. Check on accessibility, responsible engagement, have a conversation. Does your spouse see or feel it? Disempower relapse. You know, too often we look for it. You've got to get an A, or, you know, it's pass fail, and you can fail real easily. You know, so there you go again. And it's like, you know, all bets are off. You have big problems. So letting go of defense, open your heart, and take care of each other. It's a long list. It's confusing. It is complicated. You put the emotions connected to it. And it's like, so I want to try to simplify it, make it less complicated. I don't mean simplify in terms of easy. I mean simplify in terms of less complicated. And it's talk two. It's Scott and Missy. I'm going to change one thing, but I just saw one of them. So to get into this, third bullet point down says, hug until relaxed. Hug until relaxed. I'm stealing this. I should have quotes around it, actually. A guy named David Snarts. I can't recommend the book, but it's a fantastic book. It's called The Passionate Marriage. I've never read all of the book because it's just too x-rayed. I have a friend who's a counselor who continually preaches to me the Christian guy, the benefits of the book, says I need to use it as a textbook at Covenant Seminary. He graduated from my program, you know. He just can't quite hear me that I would lose my job. I mean, but it's a good book. It's an excellent book. You just really understand. Hug until relaxed is a technique. It's homework that he gives to his couples that are wrestling and rebuilding their relationship. And what he's going after is to be holding each other in a way where we're not, you know, and we're not, but we're actually each standing on our own feet and each other. Because there's something emotional and appropriately balanced in that. And it's something that we really need on a regular basis that we can walk by and miss and not understand what we're missing in the process. Which sets me up for the where I want to end. We can still keep talking, but answer questions, but this is my last thing. The second bullet point says benevolent pressure. So remember, this is Scott with our horse Missy. He, when he starts working with her, the first thing he works with her is putting a halter, a rope halter, just a rope tied in knots that comes out and halter. That he could hook a lead rope to. And so he now is, Missy's standing here, he's standing at her shoulder, and he's working with her to help him put the halter on. Contrast this with the other horse, Cabo, where it's gotten better, but in our initial days with him, you know, I'm running around the pasture trying to run this horse down so I could put the silly halter on him so I could take him somewhere to do something. And it wasn't quite that, yeah, actually some of it was that silly. And I eventually figure out a way to bribe him, you know, and a few other things, but nothing like what he's doing with Missy gradually. First time seeing a horse. And he's exactly how he started, but he starts with having her turn her head. And he's helping her. Before he's ever, he has the halter here. He's not doing anything with the halter except it's there. Stand beside her, wants her to turn her head and hold her head there so he can put the halter. I forget exactly what he did to influence that, but he was putting pressure on her, not touching her at that point, but influencing her with noise, with suggestion of what he wanted to do. Might have been putting a hand on it. I can't remember exactly what he did, but putting the pressure on. And when she responded well to it, letting the pressure off, which is, it's not so much the reward as it is, I'm asking, do you trust me and follow? And when she's following, she's a happy horse. And that in all of the things that he did with her, that developing that benevolent pressure, where it's, I'm touching you because I'm helping you. Recognize that the pressure can be a, you can't see the tenseness in my arms, but it's there. Versus the, you know, the pressure can be either way, just like the hugs can be, I'm holding you here because I have to, because you're leaning away from me. There's no relaxed in this. And without the relaxed, there's not much goodness. It's not benevolent. So, but I want to change the benevolent pressure to presence. Change the words. Presence. Even in the forgiveness, what we're striving to do, or in the trying to stop the negative dance and get to a more positive dance with each other. It's about trying to restore our opportunity and ability to be present with our spouse. There's a pressure to it. We're too present and too big, it's too scary. Or like me, who I can dissociate and drop a hat and not even know it, presence can be very small. What do I do? What do a lot of us do when presence, you know, when we're really leaning away? We use more words. It tends to get us in more trouble, actually. Rather than, can I come inside? Being vulnerable is being present. It's exposing yourself in the best sense. So when we, main reason I'm talking about this is, I'm forgetting the first one. Making me wonder if I knew it. Maybe I didn't forget it. Maybe I just didn't know it. I don't know. Because Matthew's right, that we can look at these things and kind of agree, these are good tools. And as we say that, I want to say, as soon as we start thinking that, when we've crossed over a line, I want to help us not cross it. This isn't about what to do. It's not about scripting things differently, scripting our behaviors differently, in order to get better results. Just like with our horse, it's not about training the behavior. It's establishing the relationship so we can do what we need to do in the next moment of the relationship together. And that's done by presence. It's Scott's presence with Missy that she learns. This presence as pressure is good. So that the one who is, you're exactly right. It's a system, so we're kind of hurting each other, actually. But when there are those situations, you know, big things where someone has been, it's just really messed up. A big piece of the repair is getting back to the place where it's like, my presence is a good thing. And that's the goal. That's the goal we want to go for. And the one who's been hurt has to take the risk of acknowledging, yes, your presence is a good thing. And it's the very thing that I want and need, even though it's scary. So much of those, maybe last step 4, 5, 6, in her 6 steps, are about how can presence look inviting and safe. I think trust is a big piece of it, but it's to recognize that we want to be present, we want to move back to presence in our life. It's a better word than connection. So it's like, you know what it is biblically. Some of these situations that are hard, you have that forgiveness conversation, and you come to that place, and it's like, okay, we're with each other. They're the greatest. Because out of, even though there's been pain, to not overestimate the pain, so it prevents us from going through the process, but to actually move back toward each other, as risky and scary as that can be, to find us in a place of, well, we've certainly been naked. Their steps are about openness. And I'm telling you, and I'm committing to being open. I don't want to make that mistake again. I want you to help me. And you're letting me know how much it hurt. And I'm letting you know it hurts me to hurt you that much. And it hurts me to be so flippant in the course of life that I mess up and miss you in that process. That's naked without shame, because as we, we're moving forward. As we rewrite the story, it's, so you accept me. You know the truth, but you accept me. And I accept you. That's rich. That's as good as it gets. Actually, come on. More about the process than the tools, necessarily. Questions, thoughts? What's very confusing? Karen?
I'm really intrigued by the idea of being able to pressure in terms of parenting as well. Like, I think it's just been kind of mulling around in the back of my mind since you first brought it up and then you've been talking about it again. But that idea of, I think it's so easy to get hung up, especially looking at my children and evaluating going long term and all those things.
Absolutely.
As a parent that you're thinking about,
right,
to get hung up on their behavior and lose the sight of that relationship and trust and it being for their good and like them knowing that they have that place of complete security as a foundation of your correction. And I don't know, I feel like it's really,
I have 3 thoughts on it, but before I go there, hopefully I remember them all.
Yeah.
First, create a context is, I've been thinking about it too, and one thing I'm very clear on is, haven't done enough thinking. There's a hell of a lot that I don't understand about this. So three thoughts. And you already really described this as, yes, it's better to go this way than this way. A guy named Ron Taffel is one of the best writers I've come across currently. And I haven't read his books, I've only read his articles. The Psychotherapy Networker articles, you can find that online, it's some great articles. But in the most recent article, he makes a statement about, well, he says it this way. If you ask our parents, and he's about my age, he's in his 50s. If you ask our parents why they read to us when they put us to bed at night, they most likely will say, I don't know. You know, it's just what people do. It's just what we do. They kind of don't know the reason. But we kind of, you know, maybe not at the time, that's pretty cool. There was this time that we had with them. Then he said, and he actually said, I know there's some Amazon books here. I can't remember if it's 68 or 86 thousand titles on Amazon about parenting. I mean, that's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of data. And his point was, we know the right things to do. So if you ask current parents, why did you do, and fill it in, they have an answer for it. Well, self-esteem is really important, or this is really important. And what he goes on to say is, it's a little bit like they have an agenda of what they're trying to produce in their child through their parenting, and they want to get it right. Which is all very, that's a wonderful intent. But he contrasts the two. Over here, the kids are experiencing this, and there was no agenda, the parents weren't even clear what they were doing. But they're experiencing this sense of, cool. Over here, the kids are experiencing, Taffel says is the kids know the difference. They know this is about relationship and this is more about doing it the right way. That has something to do with this. That, yes, keeping focused on relationship and that it's about the trust that we have. Something that gets us messed up is I hear a lot of times students at Covenant Seminary come in wrestling with kids. Or sometimes it's just an offhand comment. It comes up in class, people say it, other people might even snicker a little bit, like, oh yeah, that's true, you know, that's hard. And it's, well, you know, now that I have kids, the one thing that's clear is depravity. They're sinners. And people start their understanding of human beings relative to their kids with their sinners. And it's really tough to focus on relationships when you're viewing your kids as sinners, because you got to become the sin police and be reshaping them, it feels like, which is anti-gospel. So it makes a big difference into how we look at these little people. Are they the little image bearers that God has entrusted to our care, who are becoming the persons that God has formed them to be? Our responsibility is to be in that relationship and provide that relationship in which they become those people. And yes, we have responsibility to discipline. Absolutely, not throwing that out. But just like in our marriage, also in our parenting, are we leading with the relationship? That makes a lot of difference. Are we leading with our presence? Are we trying to restore trust? Or are we trying to get past our misbehaviors? It makes lots and lots of difference. Oh. I got started thinking about this before Scott came. And it was a book that my wife had that I picked up and read a chapter out of and was so impressed with. Asked if I could read it, and she's like, I don't know, I've read the whole thing, I'll do that. But I'm not done with it. Well, I understood that, so I did a big Amazon order where it's got another copy of that book, and then two copies of this guy's other book, and some of that, yeah. Well, I'll be switching. that book was called Understanding Your Dark Horse. Or Dark Horse, something. I don't remember the author's name. Actually, Xerox the chapter, I think it was chapter 7 or 8. And for the first day of class in my counseling and ethics class, I read the chapter out of the Dark Horse, Understanding Your Dark Horse. I mean, is that crazy? But it was that man that actually gave, I think it was a man, that actually gave me the language of what you're trying to do in your relationship with your horse is join the herd and be the lead horse in the herd. You're trying to be the better horse, which means you're trying to build trust. That's what it's about. We're kind of doing that with our kids. Now, at this moment, I can't remember stuff out of that chapter, but it's really okay because it's like, I don't know what to do with most of what I read there, just like I don't know what most of what Scott was demonstrating. But I know there's something there. And so, Karen, you're wrestling with this. I'm kind of like, you might read the book on natural horsemanship and see where it takes you. And you might be surprised. After doing that in the class, 33 students, I had 3, 4, 5, you know, and we're talking the next day, that was a Monday, the next day, like people kept showing up. I kept saying, I've been thinking a lot about and making an application of something different, like with their clients or their own life or their marriages or something like that. And there were different things. And it was very intriguing and instructive, you know, because they were thinking things I hadn't thought of. And it's like, it makes sense. These people have paid attention to the nature of the horse and come up with things that work best. It's learning from creation. It's learning from God's creation. That's what they do. That's why it's true. That's why it can apply to other things, because it's just learning from the way God said it. And of course, there's some consistency from nature and animals, particularly these very sensitive, they're emotionally sensitive animals, even though they have the same kind of emotion. There's just a lot that you can learn. So that's the best thing I can do. Father, I'm thankful for the opportunity to get a glimpse into the hearts of these people. Both their spouses, but each other as a thank you for that. Thank you for the encouragement that comes through that. And for the hope, the sense of that these last 2 days, or night and day, have been just another piece of the work that you're doing and the long journey that's had just a little bit of direction. Just thank you for that. Intervene in our lives and stay present in our lives and walk with us in our work. As one who gets to helicopter in and look around, then it's obvious to see that goodness and the goodness of heart. So much intention for care for each other. I just thank you for that. And I pray that you continue to bless it and bless what we're doing here together. Watch over us as we travel home. Maybe for some of us, help us to think that this is driving a mile marker and saying, from here forward,